I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday afternoon. The Republican National Convention begins today in Cleveland, and we are going to devote the next 2 hours of our program to what's going to happen. So it's an extended version of all things political. Who's going to be speaking? Who is not attending? A rather long list of dignitaries. We'll talk about the vice presidential choice and the concern after the recent shootings of police in Baton Rouge and Dallas about safety in Cleveland. We're going to have many guests joining us for a two-hour edition of All Things Political. We'll be starting with Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. Chris Deaton will be joining us, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Jill Lawrence, commentary editor of USA Today. Later, Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. Orrin Cass will join us, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and we'll be speaking with the U.S. political editor at the Daily Mail. All things political coming up in just a moment. We do want to give you the phone number. The number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. And we start with Craig Gilbert, who is in Cleveland. He has been doing terrific work reporting on actually many presidential elections and been to quite a few conventions. Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. Craig, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
How are things in Cleveland, Craig?
Today is the first day. I think the convention just got gaveled in, but the people that are going to be here are here, and it's a lot like any convention in that sense of just sort of this massive kind of political world coming together. We're going to see whether there are any surprises or not, both in the arena and outside the arena.
Yeah. You had a really interesting article about a breakdown of the latest Marquette University law poll in yesterday's paper, in which you looked at two swaths of voters who really are either very in favor of a candidate or very opposed to a candidate. Start with the educated women in the state of Wisconsin. The number here is huge in how they support the Democrat.
Yeah, so what's basically happened is, you know, the gender gap, which everybody's familiar with, has really, really gotten bigger in this race. I mean, it's far bigger than it was 4 years ago. I mean, you've got Hillary Clinton as the first female nominee. You've got Donald Trump, who's really unpopular with women, generally speaking. And so much bigger gender gap. Men are more negative toward Hillary than they were toward Obama overall, and women are a lot more negative toward Trump than they were toward Romney. And then when you add gender together with education, where we've got a new gap between college-educated voters and non-college voters, the more educated you are this year, the more likely you are to be supporting Hillary Clinton and not Donald Trump. When you add those two things together, it's the impact is just staggering, because you've got essentially Hillary Clinton leading among women who have college degrees by 38 points. The equivalent number 4 years ago in Wisconsin for Obama was, I believe, 14 points. And what's interesting about that group, again, gender and education, more educated, female, not male, is that Hillary Clinton isn't really any more popular with white college women. And I should stress, we're talking about white voters, which is the vast majority of voters in Wisconsin, but she's really no more popular among white college women than Obama was 4 years ago. The difference is that Donald Trump is way more unpopular with them than Mitt Romney was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's just, you know, got terrible numbers with this group. And then the inverse group, which is men instead of women and non-college instead of college, so white men who do not have a four-year college degree, Trump is up by 21. So you've got Trump up by 21 among the one group and Hillary up by 38 among the other group. And so the gap between, you know, kind of working class white men and college educated white women is staggering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nothing like we've really seen before. And again, it seems to be more related to one candidate's weaknesses than the other candidate's strengths, because Donald Trump is actually not only less popular than Mitt Romney was with these working class men, but he's unpopular with them. I mean, his rating, he's got more higher negatives than positives. It's just that Hillary Clinton is really, really unpopular with them. So, again, it's like these antipathies are driving these patterns, and some of these patterns are a lot stronger than they've been in the past.
You asked the question in your article, and I wonder what the answer is. Why does Trump have such a big lead with white men who don't have college degrees?
Yeah, I think it's what I just said, which is that he's running against somebody who's quite unpopular.
Why is she unpopular? Why is that?
Well, I don't know if I can give you a perfect answer to that. They both are more unpopular nominees than any group we've seen in the past. So they are both candidates with liabilities. I mean, they have different kinds of liabilities, but Trump, you know, is controversial and very divisive to some people, and even in his own party, majorities don't think he's qualified to be president. And Hillary Clinton certainly has a credibility problem, and there's certainly a lot of Clinton fatigue around her candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, men and women are reacting to that differently. I think you'd have to maybe sit down with these folks in a focus group to get a better idea of why they're seeing the two candidates so differently. I think it's not just their attitudes in the case of, working class men. It's not just their attitudes toward Hillary. I mean, Donald Trump, has been speaking to some classic kind of blue collar concerns, in talking about trade and the loss of manufacturing jobs. I mean, Hillary Clinton talks about some of those same issues too, but they've taken different positions on trade. But clearly she, her numbers, if you look at the Wisconsin poll, I mean, her negative rating with these voters, these non-college white men in Wisconsin is like, her positives are 20 and her negatives are 80, something on that order, or 70 or 75. She's got a credibility problem and an image problem with those male voters that she doesn't have to anywhere near the same degree with female voters.
So when it comes election day, who's more likely to vote? The white men who don't have college degrees, the college-educated women, about the same?
Well, it's interesting because I think the college-educated women are more likely to vote because we see, turnout rate to go up with higher levels of education. But it's important to remember that it's a much smaller group. I mean, if you're talking about college-educated women, A, there are more non-college than college voters. And B, if you're talking about women, if you go back several generations, you had lower rates of college education among women. And so, that group that's good for Trump may be twice as big as that group that's good for Hillary Clinton, but the Clinton group is voting at higher rates, and she's got a bigger advantage with them. It's so lopsided. I think that's a pretty harmful trend and pattern for Donald Trump. I mean, just to be looking at that kind of a gap among you would think would be a motivated group of voters. I think there are more questions with the non-college men about turnout. I mean, I think they're perceived as being more motivated by Trump in this election, but they're also, again, not necessarily as likely to turn out because, voters that are lower on the education spectrum do not turn out at the same rates.
So Wisconsin had this pretty big Never Trump movement, as we know, and Ted Cruz won the state by a fairly substantial margin. What does that do to the delegates who are in Cleveland from Wisconsin? Are they lukewarm supporting Trump? Are there Never Trump people who may upset the apple cart here? What's their story?
I think it's more lukewarm than Never Trump. I mean, some of the Never Trump people have just stayed away. I mean, there's a Congressman Reed Ribble from Green Bay who didn't come, and he's a Never Trump person. Mike Grebe, who is a former state party chair and a longtime Republican and conservative leader, gave up his delegate seat because he didn't want to be part of nominating Trump. So there are cases where some of those people have stayed away, which gives them less of a presence here. It's really more the sort of, a lot of these people are party loyalists, and so you know, party loyalists were not the kinds of people that were attracted to Trump in the first place.
Right.
But now that Trump has got the nomination, they're the kinds of people that want to unify and want to win. And so these are the people that have also been beating back the anti-Trump people. So it's not that they're pro-Trump, but they're anti-anti-Trump, I would say. They bristle at the notion that, you know, the delegates should be free to vote for whoever they want to, regardless of how their states and districts voted. They bristle at the idea that you're going to deny the nomination to somebody who pretty much won the nomination in the primaries. And so they're trying to, they're kind of circling the wagons here. And it's not so much out of enthusiasm for the candidate, because Trump was not the first, was the first choice of very, very few of the Wisconsin delegates who were here. It was one of his worst states. He's only got 6 out of the 42 delegates pledged to him, and some of those didn't vote for him in the primary. It's really more the kind of party loyalty kicking in, and that's why we've seen, you know, some very prominent Wisconsin Republicans, obviously the Reince Priebus, the chairman, the national chairman of the Republican Party. Some of the other RNC members from Wisconsin have been very active in fighting against the Stop Trump people in the Rules Committee, and they've also been, you know, they've been the ones running. They are the ones planning and running the convention.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this has ever happened before, Craig. Tell me if it has. But I was really struck. NPR compiled a list this morning of Republicans who've said they're not attending the RNC this week. 21 Republican senators, 21, 6 governors. Of course, we've got the former presidents, George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush, Jeb Bush is not going, former Massachusetts governor, but Mitt Romney, Bobby Jindal, David and Charles Koch, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Carly Fiorina, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and the list goes on. Is that unprecedented?
Is that unprecedented?
Yes.
Well, certainly in recent times it is. I mean, I can't remember anything like that. I mean, obviously there are a lot of things about this campaign that are unprecedented, and there's a lot of things about Trump as a candidate that are unprecedented. But yeah, no, I can't recall. I mean, there are a lot of things you can't imagine seeing. I mean, again, the idea that you'd have, you know, well-known Republicans, either former elected officials or longtime party people, you know, basically repudiating their status as delegates and skipping the convention because they feel that strongly,
right,
in opposition to the party's nominee. The idea that even that you'd have prominent Republicans who still haven't actually gotten around to endorsing them. And maybe they will come around, but it's taking an awfully long time. The idea that you'd have, you know, the party's highest elected official in terms of Paul Ryan, who has endorsed Trump, but, you know, fairly regularly having to distance himself from things Trump has said or policies that he's advocated. These are all things you just aren't used to seeing. You're not used to seeing a nominee of a party, have such high negatives in his own party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, there is some coalescing going around among Republican voters behind Trump. I mean, you look at it in Wisconsin, it was much worse for him a few months ago, where you had majorities of Republican voters that didn't like him. And the last poll Marquette did, it was, I think, you know, 2/3 of Republican voters said they had a favorable view of him, and about a quarter had an unfavorable view. I mean, those are much better than his numbers were earlier in this year, but they're nowhere near that. They're also worse than the numbers Romney had at this point 4 years ago, and they're not numbers you're used to seeing. So all of this is unprecedented.
Right.
I was just at a luncheon with Paul Ryan where somebody asked him, you know, whether Trump has changed the Republican Party. He said, yeah, but we don't know exactly how. And the question he raised is, you know, he thinks Trump is bringing some new voters into the Republican Party, but he doesn't know whether they're losing more than they're gaining. You know, are you swapping one set of voters for another? Are you subtracting as well as adding? Are you adding more than subtracting? Are you subtracting more than adding? And so mm-hmm. That's really the question from a political point of view about this election for Republicans.
Yeah. Well, they must have some sense of that, don't they? They've got a lot of good pollsters.
Well, yes. You can certainly measure it in a poll today. And I think right now, I think you'd have to say they're subtracting more than adding. The question is whether it will look like that in November. I mean, we know from the polls that, as I said before, both candidates are really viewed negatively by majorities of voters, not the same voters, but we do also know that, you know, Hillary Clinton has been a fairly consistent leader in the polls in Wisconsin and nationally. So there's certainly more concern on the Republican side than on the Democratic side about how the electoral math works, about how the map works, and how what the sort of trade-offs are in terms of shifting coalitions. And so, you know, if Donald Trump does make some inroads, which isn't guaranteed, if he does make some inroads among blue-collar voters, he still can't really afford to lose, you know, all these college-educated voters. I mean, mm-hmm. it just doesn't make the math add up. Mm-hmm. And it's not really that clear that he's breaking into the Democratic coalition at all. I mean, I think there's some hope on the Republican side that he's expanding the Republican base by appealing to blue-collar white voters, but those voters have already been moving toward the Republican Party. And if the price of doing that is losing, suburbanites, pro-business moderates, college-educated men and women, professionals, urban professionals, I mean, that's a pretty high price to pay.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one phone call for you, then we let you go to cover more of the convention, and we have many guests joining us during the course of the next hour and a half. Our number is 800-486-8655, and Marty in Bennett is our first caller. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks, Kathleen.
Sure.
So the vast numbers of Republican senators who were not at this convention, along with other peripheral people no longer in government, who are these people going to vote for?
The senators, you mean?
The senators, the Bushes, the Romneys, they're not there. They're not supporting this candidate by their inability to show up at this convention. I mean, Ron Johnson's doing it for political reasons. I'm not sure it really has anything to do with his feelings about Donald Trump as a candidate. Who are these people going to vote for?
If you look at the polling suggests that some of them won't vote. Some of them may turn out and vote for other offices on the ballot, but not for president. Some of them may vote for a third-party candidate like Libertarian Gary Johnson. Maybe a small number may vote for the Democrat, for Hillary Clinton. We don't know. In the end, what happens in elections and campaigns is the voters tend to come home, and so we're seeing that. I mean, again, the percentage of Republicans that say they're going to vote for Donald Trump is growing. It's still not as high as it should be if you're a Republican. But where we end up, where do we end up with? I mean, is there going to be less Republican loyalty to Donald Trump than there is Democratic loyalty to Hillary Clinton? That would be pretty fatal to Donald Trump, because there actually are more Democratic voters than Republican voters in most of these battleground states, like including Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So we don't know the answer to the question, yeah. but the math and the numbers have to get better for Donald Trump if he's going to win.
And finally, Craig, after these horrendous, again, more police shootings of police in Baton Rouge on the heels of Dallas, this call for open carry, which didn't go anywhere because it's against the Constitution in Ohio to not allow open carry during the convention. Do you have a sense that things are kind of on edge in Cleveland, or does it feel pretty safe?
Well, I don't have a great sense of it, just because, you know, we're all, you know, in our little bubbles.
Right.
Running around from events to events. I haven't been over to the arena yet today. I have been around over there. I did a lot of walking around Saturday and Sunday, but I think there wasn't the presence of protesters then either. So it's really, really an open question. I mean, we just don't know what to expect.
Thank you so much, Craig. Have a good week.
Okay, good
Thanks,
luck.
Greg. Yeah, and to you too. Craig Gilbert, our first guest. It's an expanded all things political this hour, the day the Republican National Convention gets started. And we thank Craig for being with us. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're going to continue our coverage of the convention. on the day that it starts, and we'll have two guests joining us the remaining hour, and we'll continue into the second hour with even more guests, and we'll be taking more phone calls. Feel free to call us anytime during the next couple hours. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And joining us now, Chris Eaton, who is in Cleveland. Chris is a senior writer at the Weekly Standard, is deputy online editor of the Weekly Standard, previously editor at Red Alert Politics and legislative and communications aide in the U.S. Congress. Chris, hello. Thanks very much for joining us, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Jill Lawrence is also with us. Jill is the commentary editor of USA Today, an award-winning journalist, a former columnist for U.S. News and World Report, and she is the author of Profiles in Negotiation and a contributor to The Surge, 2014's big GOP win and what it means for the next presidential race. Let's start with the vice presidential pick, which happened, there's so much going on, just a couple days ago, Mike Pence, before we move to other issues. Chris, your thoughts about Mike Pence and how the delegates that you've spoken with and the people in Cleveland are responding to it? Do they like the choice?
Well, being a native Hoosier, I can speak even more to the vibe of the people in the States. And, you know, they were pretty riled up about it, you know, focusing so much attention in an unusual fashion on a state that, you know, was getting the Iowa treatment, so to speak. Indiana not fully accustomed to that level of intrigue this late in the political cycle. But to a lot of people who are, you know, the more rank and file members of the Republican Party, Pence was sort of seen as a reassuring pick. You compare him to a person like Newt Gingrich and a person like Chris Christie. Pence was said to be more of someone who had a Ronald Reagan-style three-pillared conservatism with the social issues, the economic issues, the foreign policy issues, somebody who was a steadier hand than other people who could maybe bridge the gap between some of the people who were Trump skeptics and the Trump campaign himself. So in that regard, the reception has been positive. Whether or not it's a game changer and he is somebody who is going to shake the race up, you know, vice presidential picks often don't do that in the long run. But in this particular circumstance, the Pence pick seemed to please a lot of people who might have been a little more skeptical prior to his announcement.
Do you think politically, Chris, it was a good choice?
Smart choice. It was certainly a smart choice for him. The goal was to try to have somebody who tamped down some of his behavior on the campaign trail, a little bit of a yin and yang effect. But, you know, as it related to fitting Donald Trump's own personal style, if he really wanted to have somebody who, you know, was in sync with him, it would have been somebody more like a Chris Christie, the pugnacious attack dog on the campaign trail, who would have trained all of his fire on, you know, the Hillary Clinton's background and her team and trying to keep the focus on her. Newt Gingrich is, you know, certainly someone who has plenty of experience doing the Sunday show circuit and speaking at length about a great number of issues. And, you know, Trump was said to be very fond of him and have a good relationship with him. So Pence was the natural pick from the political consultant standpoint, I think is the best way to put it, but maybe not fitting his own personal style.
Mm-hmm. And Jill, you wrote an interesting piece over the weekend. Obviously, he was going to delay, but then he announced it on Twitter anyhow, the press conference to announce Pence because of the attack that killed a horrible one after another in this world, the attack that killed so many people in Nice, France. You wrote an interesting piece titled Five Words That Could Sink Trump, and that was in response to the attack and the announcement. Can you explain, please?
Well, this was not the smoothest Veep rollout, I guess you could say, as an understatement. And there was a lot of confusion both about when it would happen and who it would be, actually, even after Mike Pence and his aides had flown to New York for the announcement. And Donald Trump stunned a lot of us by postponing the announcement right after the Nice attack. And his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, went on TV the next day and said he had emotionally reacted to it. And that was, in my view, just playing into the hands. It had his own campaign manager saying in his own words that this man was, you know, a gut instinct politician who did this without really thinking about the implications He was possibly trying to appear sensitive, but he was possibly also trying to prolong suspense or win the news cycle, or, you know, the signals could possibly have been that terrorists can now control the agenda of our political campaigns. I mean, it was just a very odd thing to do, particularly with all the other circumstances surrounding the Pence pick. You know, it was an odd marriage in the first place, and the way that he went about doing it kind of fed into a lot of people's misgivings about whether he was organized and a cool head, you know, and particularly with these foreign policy and terrorism crises piling up on each other. I mean, this was just a day or two before we had the attempted coup in Turkey. It's just not good to have your campaign manager out there talking about how emotional or dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Jill's column on that, Chris? Do you agree with her?
Well, I think Jill makes a really good point about the nature of, you know, somebody being a steady hand running for the presidency amid all of this international turbulence. Look, Trump has been trying to sell himself as the law and order candidate, so to speak. He's, you know, saying that he and Pence are the law and order ticket. This is the law and order party. And that would impart at least a semblance of, you know, order inside of his own house, order inside of his own campaign. And when you have somebody who fashions himself an authoritative decision maker, you know, the guy who originated the "you're fired" phrase and made it part of our informal lexicon in the United States, you know, that casts doubt on whether or not he actually does have his own house in order and does not send a good message to the people who would go out and support him in November.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to Craig Gilbert about this earlier, but I want to ask both of you this, too, because it seems as though there will be a marked absence at the convention on the part of a number of U.S. Republican senators who are not showing up. Quite a few governors aren't showing up, but 21 senators is a lot. You have former presidents. They're always there. You know, people are applauding for them. They're not going to be there. George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush, Jeb Bush will not be there. Mitt Romney's not going to be there. Why is that, and what kind of message does it send? Are they needed in order to achieve a kind of party unity that will be important for Donald Trump to win this election, or is it just another sign to his base to encourage them to come out and vote because the establishment is not showing up for the convention?
Well, I can take that. I think that there's no question that this convention is not going to serve the traditional function of unifying the party. Mm. You know, it's just not going to happen. And I don't see how that can be a good thing just in terms of motivating Republicans, regular Republicans, to come out and vote, establishment Republicans, if you will, in some of these suburban areas in swing states. You know, it's not good to not have your former presidents coming. It's not good to have anyone, you know, with a close election like a John McCain, somebody who may not want necessarily to be associated with Donald Trump. It'll be interesting to see how many people rush to get their pictures taken with him. You know, how many people want to be identified with him. I did notice that in Wisconsin, you're putting on a pretty good show.
Yes.
Showing. Ryan Scrivens wants to put the pressure on because you've got Scott Walker and Paul Ryan and Ron Johnson all going to be speaking. So, you know, that's kind of interesting. But there's a lot of absences, and there's a lot of Trumps that are going to be speaking. And, you know, there were a lot of confusing aspects of, again, kind of like the vice presidential rollout, where the first list came out and Tim Tebow was on it, and he said it was just a rumor that he really wasn't speaking. But it's not a rumor. It's the official first version of the speaker's list. So, you know, the organizational aspects haven't been great, and just the fact that there are so many absentees, and even some people who are coming, like Nikki Haley and Tim Scott, the governor and senator from South Carolina, they won't be speaking. And they're two of the party's up-and-coming minorities. And so, you know, there's some very obvious missing pieces from
mm-hmm.
the podium.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, to piggyback on what Jill was saying, Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, made comments about not worrying about some of these absences because these absences are kind of reflective of GOP's past and their focus is more on the future. You know, to Jill's point, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico, Ben Sasse, a very prominent senator from, you know, Nebraska, partly because of his strong stance against Trump. These people are definitely the future of the Republican Party. And it would be inaccurate to, you know, dismiss these absences as just part of being, you know, the same lot of the GOP's past. These people are very much a part of the party's future. Their absence is notable, and it cuts off the number of people inside of the party, the diversity of the party from which the delegates have to hear.
Mm. But in terms of appealing to the working class, the Republican Party kind of got caught off guard by Donald Trump. I would imagine that Trump does that. That's got to be a bigger part of the Republican future, doesn't it?
Oh, it's right now it certainly is definitely part of the present. We'll see how, you know, they adapt to shifting demographics. You know, a lot of people do say it's going to be a significant problem for the party the next decade as, you know, white working class voters make up a smaller and smaller share of the national electorate. But, you know, his appeal to these sorts of voters is definitely part of his strategy this year with states like Pennsylvania, a state like Wisconsin. You know, you can almost, you know, kind of count that as the western extremity of the Rust Belt. A state like Michigan, which is certainly a long shot for a Republican in any year, and certainly will be this year as well. But that's part of the shifting electoral map that he's trying to reach out to.
What does all of this do to the future, do you think? It's kind of a big question, and who knows the answer, Jill, but this is a very, very unusual election. He's a very unusual candidate to be the head of a party to be running for president. What does it do to the party? What will, after people leave the convention, if he wins in November, what does it say? If he loses in November, what does it say to Republicans?
Well, you know, you already have, coming from people like Ross Douthat and others, you know, calls to rethink the party agenda. Because, you know, it's all very well and good to be for the working class, but even Donald Trump and certainly Paul Ryan and some of the other people who set the agenda, the policy agenda, have not really focused on what will be good for the working class. So the question is, how much do they go down that road? How much will people demand in terms of changing the agenda of the party? You know, this has been a kind of a country club party that's been concerned about tax cuts for the rich and has spent 30, 35 years believing that if people at the top do well, then people at the bottom ultimately will too. And that's been put to the test in the last 10 years. So, and people have not done well. And I think, you know, that's part of what you're seeing with Donald Trump. The other thing is, of course, the diversification of American society, the ethnic diversity, the racial diversity. You know, I guess my hope is that this is kind of the final throes of resistance to that, and that after this, we'll try to be making our peace with the fact that we're a diverse society instead of fighting it till the last dog dies.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a number of people who want to talk with both of you. Jill Lawrence, commentary editor of USA Today. Chris Deaton, senior writer at the Weekly Standard and deputy online editor of the Weekly Standard. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. John in Janesville, our first caller for you. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
I was just wondering, they said that they aren't going to allow open carry guns at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, all this time, they've told us that you got to feel safer if everyone has a gun, that you should take guns to things, because then everybody, the good guys, will all have guns. And if somebody comes in with a gun that's a bad person, they'll have all these good people blowing them away. It's a good thing, good thing. You should be happy that there's guns around, but yet they're not allowing them at their convention. Why is that?
Chris, you're there.
Yeah, well, from my understanding, you know, the rule is that there are no firearms of any kind that go into the actual arena where all the action is taking place, and that's, you know, the arenas and the arena grounds, own jurisdiction. It's a little different as it relates to the actual convention space. But, you know, being around here even for just a few hours, you know, I finally got downtown late this morning, so I've been around here for, I guess, 3 or 4 hours now. Haven't really heard people rumble about it too much, haven't heard people discuss it too much. This is, you know, a crowd of individuals that, you know, you have to remember is probably accustomed to seeing each other at a lot of NRA conventions, and and the like. So it hasn't really been much of an issue here so far, or a discussion topic.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel any tense atmosphere in the streets of Cleveland? I know the police were worried about this open carry, but it's part of the Constitution. They have to have it. But do you sense that people are worried because of all that the country and particularly the police have been through over the weekend?
Yeah, it's beginning to bud a little bit as the convention activity picks up. Obviously, the protest activity and the like will ramp up as well. Security, one of their big priorities, from my understanding, was limiting the amount of activity that can occur proximate to the actual convention site, trying to put as much distance as possible between us here in the convention center and people at the arena. And other parts of town. And that tension, will build the closer that these groups of people begin to mingle with each other. But, there hasn't been a whole lot of activity so far. I think one of the more notable demonstrations today was, Alex Jones, the InfoWars person, was having a significant crowd of people outside, yelling into a megaphone. But there really wasn't a whole lot of, I guess hullabaloo, they would probably be the best way to put it, from what I observed. Mm-hmm. But that's just one of those things that we'll have to see how it develops as the week goes on. But there certainly has been plenty of predictions and kind of a foreboding air to it around here.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Can I just to go to your caller's question, this is not unusual to not allow guns into places where political events are happening. I mean, the NRA convention didn't allow guns inside. The U.S. Capitol doesn't allow guns inside. I mean, I think my understanding is that a lot of the Trump facilities don't allow guns inside. So it's a very selective open carry.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Dorothea in Hills Point. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to give my take on the whole thing. And
sure.
As far as Trump goes, I feel personally, as a person who is going to vote for him, that there is so much corruption in Washington, D.C., and so many of these Republicans fear what he's going to do. You know, they'd probably almost rather have Hillary because she's part of the corruption. They're all corrupt, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not uneducated. I do have a college degree. But I am kind of offended by how the media keeps saying the undereducated are voting for Trump. I know a lot of people who are very intelligent that did not get a college education. So it's kind of offensive, I think, just to use that terminology when describing uneducated voters, just because maybe you only got a high school education does not mean, you're not intelligent.
No, of course it doesn't. I think that the poll numbers were just looking at breakdowns of blocks of voters, Dorothea.
Uh-huh.
So that.
But it's offensive to say that, though, because it's kind of, what I'm saying? It's putting the edge on it that, only uneducated people
yeah.
are voting for Donald Trump, and it's just not true.
Yeah, but the numbers are pointing to, for women who are college educated, the gap between women and men who do not have college degrees is huge. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
So it's going to play a role in the election, whereas the uneducated white vote is really in favor of white male vote is
mm-hmm.
very much in favor of Donald Trump. So it's just a breakdown.
Yeah.
You got to break it down some way. And it's huge. In both areas, it's huge.
Mm-hmm. And I would just like to make one more comment real quick. That to me, I'm very, very upset about Mitt Romney not supporting Trump. Trump certainly supported him when he was running and gave him money. And it really bothers me that people don't reciprocate, there should be an honest and, what am I trying to say, camaraderie that they just support him. Because he's certainly, for me, going to be better than Hillary. Hillary, to me, is so corrupt and such a liar and just a horrible person as far as I'm concerned. So that wraps it up for me.
All right. Thanks, Dorothea, for calling. Chris, you want to first respond, and then Jill.
Sure. Yeah, I think, to the caller's second point about Mitt Romney not supporting Trump. It's obviously reflective of the substantial fissure that we have seen widen inside of the party. It's definitely breaking into two separate camps. And there is the one camp that comprises people like Paul Ryan, maybe even a person like Tim Scott, a little bit of a younger generation, and a little bit more of a reform generation that is more focused on trying to take conservative principles that the party has espoused for a long time and spin them into a more solutions-oriented agenda that actually tries to make a direct connection with the working-class vote. That is something that Republicans have criticized themselves for, especially these more reform people. And then on the other side, Trump does reflect a substantially different path than that in a lot of respects with his strong anti-trade rhetoric. He is heavily in favor. He's kind of tried to dance around the edges of it, but if you read between the lines, he does believe pretty strongly in infrastructure investment to a large extent, the way a lot of Democrats do when it comes to spending and whatnot. So there are more things in that, the immigration rhetoric and the bombast, and does this represent the character that people would expect in a Republican nominee. Mm-hmm. So there's just a substantial split there, and it's reflective of that.
Yeah, I don't know how you unify that, Jill, because he has said some incredibly outrageous things that are mean, that they are bigoted, that are racist. I don't know how you come to terms with that to embrace him as a candidate. How do you do that, even though you know that it would behoove the Republicans to do so?
That's why you're seeing so many of these big shots in the party hedge their bets or just not want to be associated with it. This everyone has been commenting about the 2012 autopsy report about why the Republicans lost. And what's happened since then has been exactly the opposite. I think the epitome of it was when the platform changed illegal immigrants to illegal aliens. The language has just gotten harsher and harsher. So, the question is whether this is a trend for the party or whether this is an aberration and things are going to bounce back after this election. I guess if Donald Trump were to win and he were to make a lot of investments in infrastructure and he were to pull back on some of our alliances and he were to keep us out of foreign entanglements and spend more money at home, that to some extent those are things that have been associated with Democrats, but not always. More lately, that's been bipartisan in past years. So, his whole thing is let's make a deal. I think the whole Republicans party of no will go by the boards if he gets elected. He'll be negotiating. So, it could be a more constructive era than we're thinking, but I do think that there's the language and the rhetoric and the kind of the attitudes that is a big stumbling block for people.
We'll hear more of your voices in addition to the voices of Jill Lawrence, commentary editor of USA Today, Chris Deaton, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Republican National Convention, as you well know, starts today, so we're doing a full two-hour kind of preview of who we're going to be hearing and how the Republican delegates are entering this convention, and all of this on the heels of some horrendous news and violence in this country and abroad. We'll also spend the second hour of our show talking about the convention as well. Sean Johnson, who is our ace state capitol reporter, is in Cleveland. Orrin Cass will join us from the Manhattan Institute, and also the political editor at the Daily Mail, the U.S. political editor. So all of that is coming up, and you are too. 800-486-8655. One line is open for you right now if you'd like to call in. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655. A special treat for you on our Facebook page. Scotty's doggy came to visit today, and there's a beautiful picture of his beautiful dog, Charles, or Charlie, on our Facebook page. Who I tried to interview, but he didn't want to talk, really. So he's a beauty. So if you love dogs, we do. Go look at Charlie. Let's go back to phone calls. Mike in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to take a look at Governor Mike Pence and his connection to the Koch brothers, the Wizards of Wichita. And, is this the way for Charles and David Koch to get their foot in the door to the presidency? Vis-a-vis Mike Pence and what the connection there might be to those guys.
All right. As I understand it, they're on the will not show up list, though, aren't they, Chris, the Koch brothers?
Mm-hmm. And also, I did read a report that, you know, regardless of Pence's selection, they really don't have much of a plan financially to ramp up their investment in this election on behalf of Republicans or on behalf of Republican causes as a result. And that's, you know, one of those things that people thought maybe, you know, Pence being a more establishment type of pick and someone who a lot of rank and file folks in the party could rely upon more as a steadier hand, maybe that would lead to more fundraising for the ticket. But so far, at least as far as the Koch brothers are concerned and other big bundlers elsewhere, doesn't really seem to be the case right off.
Mm-hmm. Jill, you want to respond?
Well, the Koch brothers, as I understand it, are rather libertarian, and Mike Pence is anything but. You know, he's the one, the governor who got in a lot of trouble, a lot of hot water, when he signed a Religious Freedom Act that many interpreted as extremely hostile to gays, and so you know, he didn't handle that well at all. But that's exactly the kind of thing that libertarians don't like. So you know, he and Donald Trump have a lot of disagreements on issues, and not just social issues, the war, the Iraq war, just all kinds of, you know, from A to Z, Mike Pence has been reinventing himself. So the most influence I think he's going to have is with Christian conservatives, and they are not the money people. That is just not the same thing at all.
Mm-hmm. Is there going to be, Chris, a floor fight at the convention? Will Trump face one?
Oh, well, it looks like right now this is one of those developing stories as we speak. And I think just within the last hour, a Rules Committee meeting wrapped up. There was no drafting ratification of the so-called minority report that would allow delegates to unbind themselves, have some sort of conscience language. But the latest news that I understand is that a sufficient number of states have secured signatures necessary to bring a ballot directly to the floor.
And that's been
one of the big fears is that, you know, this turns into a very public, messy spectacle that is not a particularly good look for the party. But again, this is one of those things that's kind of developing as we speak, but it certainly looks like there is certainly a non-zero chance that there will be a floor fight.
Mm. And when would that happen? It would be brought to the floor later in the week?
Yeah, that I do not know. The votes, what Chairman Reince Priebus specified today at the call of the convention is that a party secretary needed to be notified at least 1 hour in advance of this being brought to the floor. So, you know, from my understanding, it would be a sooner rather than later type of event, but Priebus did specify that the party wanted advance notification of the receipt of these signatures. So that process might be undergoing as we speak on the phone right now. Again, it's a fluid situation,
right.
But there's a lot of action going on with respect to that issue today.
So. Mm. All right. Thanks for the info. Let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Quick quote from CNN 3 days ago. Two lines. Early last year, Pence made plans to launch his own state-run, taxpayer-funded news site called Just In, which would publish stories about Pence and his administration written by state press secretaries. Pence even brought in a former Indianapolis Star reporter to oversee it. Unfortunately for Pence, the idea died. CNN caught wind of it. It caused an immediate uproar. The Atlanta dubbed the idea Pravda on the Plains, and Pence quickly announced he was canceling the project. I think it's very important for people to really understand who is on the ticket, who is running, and who the Republicans have reached out to. I'll listen off the air.
All right, thanks, Jeff. Jill.
Well, actually, you know, that's a template for, I'm sure, what Trump would like to do, have his own news service and not have to worry about reporters at all. But that was, you know, I have to give credit to Pence. He came up with the idea. He's a former radio host.
Yes.
It met with ridicule, and he immediately nixed it. So, I mean, that was a case of good judgment, I think, or bad judgment followed by good judgment. So, I mean, all politicians would like to control the press. That just was a little bit too obvious a move.
And he called his show, it wasn't the name of it, but he described it as Rush Limbaugh Light. Have either of you heard portions of Pence's radio show? It must be on tape somewhere.
Not me, sorry.
No. Have you, Chris?
Actually, I have not. I think growing up in Indiana, even that predated me a little bit from his time in Congress, but he did broadcast out of a little town that was about 45 minutes south of Indy. But I have heard him on the radio plenty of times himself, and he does have the broadcaster type of feel down to a T, no question.
Does he? Yeah, I'm sure that he'll be good on the stump. Well, what are you looking forward to this week? We're going to hear from a lot of members of the Trump family, aren't we, Chris?
That's exactly right. They are going to be, it sounds like, the stars of the night.
Right, I know.
There have been reports out there that Trump himself is going to fly in to introduce Ivanka today and then fly back out. But that is going to be part of the convention this year. Trump really wanted to put together a more non-politically involved lineup mm-hmm. this year of speakers, trying to reach out to figures in the sports communities and whatnot. Person after person was not biting on that.
So that
kind of leaves the lineup a little empty of what the original goal was, and I think we kind of saw the mad scramble of the lineup itself actually being released really just in the last day and a half here. So my biggest curiosity with respect to speakers is just kind of seeing what kind of energy is going to be in the building, what kind of reception these people get.
Thank you both so much for being with us. It'll be an interesting week. Thanks, Jill.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Good to have you here. Chris, thank you so much. Join us again, please.
Certainly. Thank you.
Good. Jill, commentary editor of USA Today, and Chris Deaton, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this show, and Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. More political news ahead.